The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. This is from the Lifestyle section, the 15 best spring flowers for a bright, beautiful garden. Get those gloves ready. By Erica, A-R-R-I-C-C-A, Ellen Sansone. If you're craving color after a long, cold season, and honestly, who isn't, take heart. Spring is just around the corner, and while some stunning flowers appear in the dark months of winter, Mother Nature's real show begins when pretty primroses, bee-friendly crocuses, and more of the first spring flowers bloom, usually between late February and early March, and continues all spring and summer. In case you were wondering, yes, that's also why many popular flower festivals take place during spring. But before every stunning pot and hanging basket, there are a few things you should keep in mind. First, some spring flowering annuals, perennials, which come back every year, and shrubs can be planted in March, April, and even May. But other spring bloomers, such as daffodils, must be planted in the fall. So make sure to read the plant tag or description before buying them so you know what to expect. Equally important, pay attention to what kind of light your garden gets. As a general rule, full sun means 6 or more hours of direct sunlight per day. Part sun is about half that. And shade means an area doesn't get any direct sunlight or only early morning sun. And if you are planting shrubs or perennials, you should also know your USDA hardiness zone, so you can choose plants that will survive winter in your part of the country. Now, pull on your favorite gardening gloves and rubber shoes and start planting everything on our list of the best flowers for spring. Pansy. Pansies are some of the earliest annuals you can plant in spring. So, as soon as you can dig in with a garden trowel, plant pansies. Pro tip, they look equally beautiful in hanging baskets, window boxes, and pretty pots. Their cheerful faces and bright colors will put you in a good mood every time you see them. They fade in summer's heat, but may rebound when cool weather arrives again in the fall. They thrive in full sun. Primrose. These sweet little flowers are some of the first perennials to bloom in spring. For such a delicate-looking flower, they're tough as nails, and many types are hardy to USDA Zone 3. There are hundreds of species, so read the label to find one for your zone. They work well in partial sun. Forsythia. It's a sure sign that spring has arrived when the forsythias bloom. These sunshine-yellow shrubs are covered in flowers first, leaves later. They're extremely cold-hardy and can be planted in early to mid-spring. Read the label, though, because they range in size from a few feet to 20 feet tall. If you need to trim forsythia to control its size, do it immediately after they bloom. Otherwise, you cut off next year's flowers. They flourish in full sun. Lilac. The sweet scent of lilacs with their purple, pink, or white blooms and heart-shaped leaves may remind you of your grandma's garden because this plant is an old-fashioned favorite. Once established, lilacs can live for decades. Look for newer varieties which bloom again, though not as impressive as the first show. Later in the season, they need full sun. Weigela. This beautiful shrub with trumpet-shaped flowers blooms in late spring in a riot of pink, purple, or white. Newer varieties rebloom off and on until frost. They thrive in full sun, but they prefer afternoon shade in hot climates. Bearded iris. With sword-shaped leaves and striking flowers in a rainbow of colors, bearded irises make a lovely garden border. They range in height from 12 inches to several feet tall. A common mistake is to plant them too deep. Their rhizomes need to be near the soil surface, roughly 3 inches deep. They require full sun. Creeping phlox. This low-growing perennial forms a spreading mound that's carpeted in small flowers in shades of deep pink to lavender in mid-spring. It's a lovely ground cover that works well on slopes but needs full sun. Daffodil. With their trumpet-shaped cups and sunny yellow color, daffodils remind you that spring really is here. They come in an array of sizes from 6 inches to 2 feet tall. Different varieties bloom from early to late spring. The only kicker is that if you want to enjoy these spring beauties, you must plant them in fall before the ground freezes. Group them together for best effect instead of planting just one bulb here and there. Rodents and deer usually ignore these plants. They love full sun. Columbine. You'll find columbine in delicate shades of pinks and purples or bright corals and reds. These flowers look equally at home in formal or cottage gardens and provide early season nectar for pollinators. They like shade. Hellebore. This perennial with glossy leaves and ruffled petals and exquisite flowers in every color is also called Lenten rose because it blooms in late winter or very early spring during Lent. It's incredibly cold-hardy, and it lives for many years once established. Plant them in part shade to full shade. Crocus. The tiny cup-shaped blooms of this flower sometimes appear when snow is still on the ground. Plant them in the fall for spring displays. Not only do bees love them, but they're also a favorite treat for chipmunks and other resident rodents. So consider planting these in a pot layered under daffodil bulbs to try to outsmart hungry critters. They flourish in full sun. Dianthus. Dianthus is a perennial that comes in many forms from creeping to upright up to about 2 feet tall. It often has fringed petals, and its gorgeous colors include every shade of pink, white, coral, and peach. Plant them in full sun. Tulip. The queen of the springtime garden, tulips come in many colors and shapes, including single form, multiple flowers on a stem, and doubles, which resemble peonies. In most of the country, they're treated as annuals, and new bulbs are planted every year. Plant these in the fall for spring blooms next year. They thrive in full sun. Lily of the Valley. One of the most popular flowers for weddings, this old-fashioned perennial is covered with tiny white bell-shaped flowers that have an incredibly sweet fragrance in mid-spring. The Lily of the Valley is a fast-spreading ground cover that can quickly take over an area, so don't plant it too close to other shade perennials. It thrives well in part to full shade. Lupin. Pollinators love the tall, stately spikes of white, purple, and pink lupin. This perennial will survive in most climates and makes an attractive vertical accent in the garden. It grows from 20 to 40 inches tall, depending on the variety. Lupin does best in part shade to full sun. This next article is from the wellness section. The unforgettable thing a stranger said when I lost my child. It stung in the moment, but came true with the gift of time. This article is by Claire McIntosh. I couldn't tell you what month it was, but there were daffodils, so it must have been spring. A few weeks after Alex died, I suppose. 2 months at most. The heads of the daffodils were heavy with rain, their stems wrapped in damp paper towels and aluminum foil. Attached to the flowers was a woman. "How are you?" she asked. "How was I?" "I was dying." My heartbeat was erratic, a pulse thrumming in my ears like an overhead jet. My skin hurt as though I had the flu. So sensitive to touch, I could only wear the softest clothes. Clothes that hadn't seen the inside of a washing machine for a week or more. My husband was at work and our surviving twin still in intensive care. so the woman must have caught me in a rare moment at home. I wondered if she'd come by at other times, if the daffodils were on their second or third outing. "I'm okay," I said, "because that's the script, isn't it? I imagine you've said it too, standing upright, shoulders back and chin raised, to hide the fact that inside you're disappearing, or would like to. You tilt your head to match theirs." "I doubt that," said the daffodil woman. "May I come in?" I shuffled aside. The woman was a stranger, but that in itself had ceased to be strange. The weeks had been full of uninvited guests, doctors, funeral directors, bereavement counselors. Once a priest sent at the request of a family friend in another town. I didn't ask for any of them. I didn't want any of them. None of us does, yet grief brings them all to our door. Our house at the time was tall and thin. There was a tiny walled garden at the front, where the cat slept in a flower bed, and the gate banged in the wind when the postman left it open. I was the local police sergeant, and my commute to work was from one end of the street to the other. I hadn't been at work for a long time, and I couldn't foresee a time when I would go back. "I am so sorry your son died," the woman said when we were sitting down. I might have offered her a cup of tea. She might have accepted. I was staring at the daffodils, at the tiny fruit flies crawling out of them. But at the sound of her words, I looked up. Whoever this woman was, she'd lost someone, too. You can tell, don't you think? Sometimes it's in the way people hold themselves, the direct smile that doesn't slide away in the way so many well-meaning gazes do, as though it hurts to see our pain. But mostly it's the way they speak, statements of fact instead of euphemisms, direct, almost blunt. This is what happened. It's awful, but there it is, unavoidable. Someone died. "What was his name?" she asked. I believe this to be the single most important question you can ask someone grieving, yet I can count on one hand the number of people who have asked it. They ask instead, "How did he die?" as though the cause were more important than the life it took. My son's name was Alex. We chose Alexander, knowing it was too big a name for such a small boy. When he was born, I placed my little finger into the curl of his hand and imagined the man he would one day become. So much of grief is about absence, isn't it? Not only the absence of the one we love, but the stealing of memories not yet created. The opportunities missed. The father who doesn't get to walk his daughter down the aisle. The grandmother who misses out on holding her first grandchild. Alex, who never grew into his name. I wish I could remember the daffodil woman's name. I wish I remembered the name of the child she'd lost. She stayed for an hour or so, and all the time I clutched the flowers she'd brought and stared at those tiny flies. She had picked them from her garden, I suppose, taken the time to collect them, wrap them in damp paper, and bring them to the door of a stranger who couldn't even make eye contact. It remains one of the kindest things anyone has ever done for me. I promise it won't always hurt like this, the woman said. Her own grief had been unbearable, she said in the beginning. She had thought she would die from the pain. She had been unable to speak, to move, to function. She told me about her son and how he'd died all those years ago. I listened to her voice, matter-of-fact and calm, and for £1,000,000 I would never have shared the thought in my head as she spoke. I'll tell you, though, I thought, you can't have really loved him. I'm not proud of it, but grief isn't all soft focus walks through graveyards and quiet sobbing over kitchen tables. Grief isn't romantic. It's painful and ugly, as often filled with anger and bitterness as love. If the daffodil woman had truly loved her son, I reasoned, she wouldn't be able to talk about him so easily. Look at you, I thought, properly dressed, with a job, a family, a life. I will never be like that again. My son has died, and I will never, ever get over it." "It's very early days for you," the woman said, "but I promise it will get easier." Afterward, I stood in the kitchen and cried until I couldn't breathe. Things would not get easier. Whatever grief my unexpected visitor had endured was nothing compared to mine. My own grief was real. It was raw and agonizing, and it was going to destroy me. In years to come, I would not speak about my son with composure. I would not turn up at a stranger's door with daffodils and comfort, because I would still be broken myself. My grief was different. As I write this, it is February. Still winter, technically, but there are signs of spring everywhere I look, and morning frosts give way to blue skies on enough days to hint at better times ahead. Our new house has a garden, a long, wide lawn that stretches towards fields, and poking through the grass beneath the trees are dozens of daffodils, waiting to flower. Every autumn I plant dozens more, burying them beneath the peeled-back turf like treasure. The thought of them carries me through the winter. I can't see them, but I know they are there, promises of spring, riding out the dark days until it is time. In the supermarket, buckets of daffodils sit by the cash registers, rubber-banded and quiet in bud. I take a bunch every week, dripping water over my shopping. The flowers open 2 days later, sunny and smiling, and every time I see them, I think of my boy. I prefer to leave my garden daffs in the ground. Seems unfair to uproot them when they've worked so hard to flower where they stand. But sometimes I snip a few long stems for a vase. "What's that weird smell?" asks a teenager drifting into my study. That same teenager who all those years ago was still in intensive care. That same teenager who lost a twin brother the day I lost a child. "It's spring," I say. Buddy's already gone in search of something more interesting than his mother and a vase of lopsided flowers. My fingers hover over my keyboard. I've lost my thread. A tiny insect climbs out from the trumpet of a daffodil before picking its way around its frilly edges, each undulation a miniature mountain to climb. "It will get easier," the woman said. "Not better, but easier." And it has. Accompanying this article is a book, 18 Assurances on Grief, I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This, by Claire McIntosh. It's on sale for $15 at Amazon and $17 at Walmart. Over in our book section, How Working on America's Most Wanted Led to the Most Important Personal Decision of My Life. In her new memoir, Combat Love, CNN correspondent Allison Camerota reveals what hunting down fugitives on America's Most Wanted taught her about finding the one. And this article is by Allison Camerota. My first day at America's Most Wanted, I was nervous. My job would be to dig up new and gripping crime stories every week, though I didn't know how to do that. So I showed up bright-eyed with my reporter's notebook wide open, ready to absorb the expert advice of my seasoned co-workers. Instead, they immediately issued a grave warning. A senior producer pulled me into her office, lowered her voice, and told me to brace myself. "Just wait until the nightmares start." "Nightmares? Oh, yeah," a male production manager agreed. "The stories are terrifying. All the violence, I haven't been able to sleep in a year." I was so eager to be a reporter, it hadn't occurred to me that diving into the details of murders, rapes, and abductions every day might take a psychological toll. So I braced and waited for the stories of blood and gore to seep into my subconscious, for the images of butcher knives and claw hammers to hack at my nerves, and the backstories of murderous revenge plots to exact payment from my sleep. I waited. And while waiting, I kept skipping into work, digging up my next cold case in Cleveland, schmoozing a new FBI agent in Detroit, and planning my next shoot at the cop shop in Kansas City. While waiting, I wined and dined my detective sources with my new expense account. And then I waited more, as the fugitives I profiled every Friday night kept getting captured. After about 3 months of waiting, I realized that reporting on grisly crimes was actually making me feel safer. Before I worked at AMW, as we called it, most of my ideas about violent crime came from movies. So I thought it was entirely possible that a group of teenagers could be partying at a lake house on Halloween night when a psychopath, in a hockey mask, broke in and managed to stab every single one of them while they tried to call for help on a cut phone line. I also thought it was utterly plausible that you could encounter a conniving cannibal who could convince you to enter his basement, lit by one naked bulb, before he chopped you up for dinner. Basically, before AMW, I thought violent crime was random and common. But in fact, in many cases, alarm bells and red flags pop up all over the place before something violent happens. It's also those clues and foreshadowing that create a successful crime show. The idea that if I paid attention, I could see trouble coming from a distance deeply comforted me, as opposed to, say, blithely coming home one day to find your screen missing, your jewelry gone, and your dad arrested. There was another interesting and unexpected side effect of chasing fugitives. Empowerment. The fugitive might have a gun, but I had a microphone. And I noticed that when I hooked that lavalier mic into the collar of a victim, it transformed them into an emboldened survivor, ready to claw back their power. Even the youngest one somehow knew that with a TV camera on their side, the tables had turned. Now the fugitive was the one running scared. "We're coming to get you," our host John Walsh promised. "You can run, but you can't hide." While hunting for fugitives, I was also searching for love. From the outside, my love life looked great. I was a serial dater, going to cool restaurants and concerts with various handsome, fun-loving boyfriends, straight from one to the next. But when it came time to truly commit, I hit a wall. Then, at 26, I fell in love with a tall, dark, and handsome network news producer. From the instant we met, he and I were thunderstruck by a feeling that something intense is happening here, which was awkward because I was sitting next to a different boyfriend at the time. For a month, I secretly flitted between both guys until I came down with a debilitating case of double vision that I didn't need a shrink to diagnose. It resolved the second I broke up with the first guy. The network producer and I agreed that we were pawns of fate and meant to be together. For months, we finished each other's sentences as we jetted off to Spain or a Caribbean island for fun. But at the witching hour of 6 months, he grew jealous and accusatory and complained I wasn't giving enough emotionally. Well, that was one of his myriad complaints. He was highly mercurial. We'd be laughing over a plate of pasta and some Chianti 1 minute, and the next he'd need to know why a cop was calling me at night or if I was attracted to a certain editor. He demanded I tell my platonic guy friends to back off and began insisting I was emotionally dysfunctional. I could never accept blame for our issues. It was horribly destabilizing, not knowing when he'd be set off or if our relationship was moving forward or falling apart. As he withdrew, I turned into a whirling dervish, trying to prove I was worthy of his love and emotional return. We'd fight and reunite, a vicious, exhausting cycle. My old intimacy-slash-distant dance was never-ending. The conference room walls at AMW were covered in funny quotes written on the walls in magic marker. Usually the quote was something one of us reporters or a producer had said in a pitch meeting, i.e. there's nothing quite like toying with the minds of violent criminals. AC 51394. Sometimes the quotes came from a criminal. My favorite was from a fugitive who uttered this pearl of wisdom to his cellmate just before climbing out an unlocked window and escaping the county jail. The last freedom is the freedom to flee. By my late 20s, much of my life had been devoted to this felonious philosophy. I often found bailing out of a tough situation to be the best solution. I particularly liked the element of surprise, sometimes leaving so fast it left someone's head spinning. Fleeing a problem was so much easier than fixing it. But with my mercurial boyfriend, I was determined to do something different. I was determined to stop running. I was 29 years old. In the space of 1 month, my college roommate got married, then another. My office mate announced her engagement, and another friend told me she was pregnant. I desperately wanted the relationship happiness I saw blooming around me as I continued soldiering through battle with the disparaging producer. I was going to have to learn somehow, some way, to stay in a relationship. And here was my chance to prove I could handle a Herculean challenge. Don Quixote had nothing on me. I also believed his nasty critiques about me were true. I was dysfunctional. I did have a problem with emotional intimacy. Maybe by staying, I could prove us both wrong. Over the next year, I grew more miserable by the day. When the endless fighting and reuniting became unbearable, I suggested we take a 3-week break. I feared I would be devastatingly lonely, but found myself accidentally having fun with friends and dancing with cute guys at beach bars. Still, when the 3 weeks were up, I asked him to take me back. Thank God he didn't. I'd been at America's Most Wanted for 5 years and in Washington, D.C. for more than 10. I wanted a new job. I wanted a loving relationship. I wanted the freedom to flee. So again, the book that this is talking about is Combat Love by Alison, that's A-L-I-S-Y-N, Camerota, C-A-M-E-R-O-T-A, and it's $28 at Amazon. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This article is from the relationships section. Should you really break up with that friend? The case for working through issues with a bestie and what to do when you just can't. By Charlie Burlock. With spring in the air and the season's obligatory cleaning on the mind, many of us are itching to Marie Kondo our lives, from our overstuffed closets to our social circles. But even the most, high-maintenance friendships shouldn't get the same treatment as our old JV badminton jersey. Just because the relationship is not immediately sparking joy might not necessarily mean it's time to pull the plug. Opting not to work on, or even formally end, friendships has, in recent years, been wildly rebranded as a wellness imperative, a means of protecting your peace, respecting your self-worth, or cutting out toxic people. Take, for example, a recent viral TikTok in which a young woman brags about ghosting her close friend and former roommate for a series of arguably minor infractions, none of which were discussed with the dumpee. Commenters cheered the dumper on for recognizing the signs and standing up to gaslighting. When you look at the science of friendship, however, it's hard to see cutting ties as a form of self-care. We all know friendship is good for us, but it's hard to overstate just how good. Researchers have found that people who have five or more friends they feel comfortable sharing their struggles with are 60% happier than those with four or fewer, implying that the loss of a single friendship can put a major dent in our overall life satisfaction. The strength of our social bonds is also one of the strongest predictors of our physical health, as strong, or in some cases, stronger than smoking, high blood pressure, and obesity. Findings on female friendship are even more compelling. Women who have strong bonds with other women are not only better at regulating their emotions, but also receive more emotional support, have more satisfying romantic relationships, experience more career advancement, and make more money than women who don't have female-dominated circles. Alarmingly, research tells us that, on average, we lose half of our friendships every 7 years, and many end not with a bang, but with a whimper. Often when conflict arises in friendships, it goes unaddressed, says science writer Lydia Denworth, author of Friendship. People just slink away or let the friendship fade, without a conversation or even a cursory breakup text. Why are we so quick to quit? Friendship coach Danielle Bayard Jackson, host of the Friend Forward podcast and author of Fighting for Our Friendships, has a theory. She speaks to a lot of individual clients who complain about feeling a lack of support or reciprocity in their friendships. Her first question is always, "What did she say when you told her?" Often the response is that the client hasn't broached the topic with her friend. That's right. These women are actively seeking friendship counseling, yet many of them haven't even taken the first step of actually talking to their friend before seeing an expert. What's so weird about friendships is that there are prescribed times to talk about our progress in every other context, but this one, Jackson explains. We have performance reviews at work. There is an expectation in romantic relationships that we should check in and voice our needs. And you can't simply ghost your sister because you're going to see her at Christmas. Professional, romantic, and familial bonds are more culturally valued. And so there are rituals in place to motivate us to work through our issues rather than abandoning them entirely. And yet, the loss of a friendship is devastating. In her book about being a palliative caregiver, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, Brony Ware writes that one regret is not giving friendship the time and effort that they deserved. And in their co-authored book, Big Friendship, Amananatu Sow and Anne Friedman point out that being dumped by a friend can feel a lot more personal than being dumped by a lover, because you can't blame a fizzled-out sex life or an attraction to a new partner. One listener to the pair's tragically defunct friendship podcast wrote of her sudden split, "It feels worse than any breakup, any job loss, and any family death I've experienced." A gentler path forward. So, rather than ghosting a friend when the going gets tough, make an effort to communicate with respect and kindness. The first line of friendship defense should always be a candid conversation, Jackson says, one free from therapy speak and corporate buzzwords. "If I've been holding your hair back in the bathroom, I know all your business. I cannot suddenly talk to you like HR. It's cold, impersonal, and it feels really, really hurtful," she says. She suggests speaking face-to-face to avoid slipping into stilted language. It's hard to say, "I've identified some areas for potential growth" out loud, and even harder if you're looking into your best friend's eyes. While there's no one-size-fits-all template for these conversations, Jackson does have tips for making them both productive and authentic. She will sometimes do an exercise with her clients where they write down everything they want to say, go back and highlight any sterile or templated language, and replace the impersonal phrases with feeling-centered language. For example, instead of saying, "I really don't have the bandwidth to plan around your constant flakiness," try saying, "I feel really hurt when you cancel last minute. I moved a lot of things around and was looking forward to boogieing to Beyonce with you." The changes are small, but they are meaningful. They come from a place of warmth, care, and shared history. But if you can't work it out. If after a conversation, or ideally a few, your friend is still not meeting your needs, it doesn't necessarily mean the relationship is doomed. Rather than questioning whether a friend belongs in your life, it may be worth wondering if they belong in the role you have assigned them. If you have a friend who disappears when you're struggling, but who is a blast on a night out, you might want to find someone else to call when you need an emotional rock and reach out to her when booking a trip to Cancun. "I'm not going to expect something I am not getting and that they can't deliver," says Denworth. There are, of course, instances when a friend is simply not able to show up in your life in a way that adds to it. Maybe you don't like who you are when you're with them. Maybe they seem to root for your failures. Whatever the reasons, it's best to be honest about what's going on. A main source of stress for those involved in friendship breakups is when they don't understand why a friend has exited their lives, writes Jacqueline Mraz of Girl Talk, a book on the science of female friendship inspired by her own painful friend breakup. "If you know exactly what happened, it's easier to find closure," she told me. So instead of listing every single way the friend has wronged you, try to emphasize the ways you're going to pursue what you need, suggests Jackson. For example, "I think I need to be in spaces where I feel freer to be myself" is a lot easier to swallow than, "Here are all the ways you have made me feel small over the past decade." By bowing out with grace and honesty, you leave the door open for the friendship to resume down the line, once you, they, or your life circumstances have changed. Denworth recently experienced this firsthand when she reconnected with a group of friends from college. "It felt a little bit like I found a sweater in the back of my closet that I'd forgotten," she recalls. "The friendship might not have been the right fit all those years ago, but it looks great on me now." This is in the skin and makeup and beauty section. Forget anti-aging skin quality is the new standard. Some women are thinking less about wrinkles and more about looking like the glowiest version of themselves. Here's how top skin pros suggest we achieve that. This article is by Katie Becker. In recent years, the term anti-aging has come under fire. Some find it disrespects the value of maturity and well-earned smile lines. Others say it's the antithesis of living. What's the alternative to growing older? That isn't pretty. And others say age really is nothing but a number. Let's not obsess or avoid. Of course, looking better and looking younger are not synonymous, says Cambridge, Massachusetts dermatologist Ranella Hirsch, M.D., whose patient base includes numerous women who make their living in front of the camera. The people who look great at 50 don't necessarily look younger than their age, but they do have good skin quality. It's been nurtured and protected. It's radiant and robust, and when I gently pinch it, it still has that spring. In other words, their skin has firmness, elasticity, a glow, and sure, some visible lines. Think Isabella Rossellini or Michelle Yao. Even though skin quality is less quantifiable than, say, counting wrinkles and measuring their depth, a medical definition for the term is emerging, thanks in part to the 2023 FDA approval of a new filler called SkinVive by Juvederm, which is marketed as an injectable that improves skin quality. It's been available in the EU since 2017 under the name Volite. Interestingly, New York City dermatologist Makrine Alexiadis, MD, PhD, describes this new aesthetic as part of a backlash against bad filler and cookie-cutter faces, the result of patients and their doctors erasing every last wrinkle, marionette line, or sag. We've been seeing faces with disturbingly similar topography in our feeds and on the red carpet for years, but now the desire to actually look like yourself has taken hold, even among some high-profile, formerly done faces like Pamela Anderson, who is in her makeup-free renaissance, and Courtney Cox, who has shared her filler regret. That doesn't mean they or their cosmetic docs are doing nothing. More doctors are coming around to this understated approach as the population becomes wise to the look of overdone faces, says Chicago-based plastic surgeon Julius Few, MD. The way to achieve good skin quality is not with a single short-term fix. Oh, there's a wrinkle. Fill it. It's a holistic, long-term approach. I sandwich multiple treatments to treat all of the skin. Topical skin care addresses the top. Lasers treat the middle, and dermal fillers support underneath. With that in mind, here's how to optimize your skin quality while looking like you. Take your daily routine seriously. You cannot get around doing a daily skincare routine, says anesthetician and owner of Rescue Spa, Danuta Mylock, who has been treating complexions in Philadelphia and New York City for more than 30 years. She says a consistent regimen is the common denominator among her chronologically older clients with beautiful skin quality. It's like working out. If you only go to the gym once a month, you're not actually going to be in shape, she says. Scroll down for our skincare recommendations. Combat skin stress. After age 25, damage starts to accumulate. Skin cells lose the ability to repair themselves because of exposure to UV rays, pollution, and other environmental stressors, Alexiadis says. Applying a serum with antioxidants like vitamin C and peptides can help repair the DNA damage. It's also worth considering skin care with adaptogens. These plant-based ingredients help your body respond to stress, which then reduces visible redness, uneven tone, dullness, rough texture, or pore size. Protect your skin barrier. Microneedling rollers, vibrating cryo wands, DIY acid peels in recent years. People have taken pro-level skincare treatments into their own hands. And like clockwork, anestheticians and derms have seen a surge in irritated complexions. Rebuilding the important lipids or mortar between the bricks of your skin cells is critical for hydration, smoothness tone, and the skin functions that maintain skin quality. The skincare barrier is the line of defense that people don't give enough love and respect to, says Hirsch. You'll know yours is damaged if you have itching, tightness, flakiness, and redness. To fix it, she suggests using hydrating cleansers and moisturizers only, and avoiding all active ingredients until any redness is gone. Wear the damn sunscreen. Of course, skin quality is also about your overall health. There are things you know you should not do, like smoking and scrubbing your skin to death, and things you know you should, like protecting yourself from the sun, says Hirsch. This is particularly true for less melanated skin. Per a 2013 study published in the journal Clinical, Cosmetic, and Investigational Dermatology, 80% of visible facial aging in Caucasian women, including wrinkles, texture changes, and pigmentation, may be attributed to UV exposure. All skin tones should wear at least SPF 30 and reapply every 2 hours or after swimming or sweating. Striving for this is worth it to maintain skin quality long term. You could inject a bit of bounce. Back to the new hyaluronic acid filler we mentioned. Think of SkinVive by Juvederm as a hydrating serum in injectable form. It's completely different than in any other filler in several ways, says Alexiadis, who was the lead investigator on the product and spent more than 15 years helping create the skin quality indication. First, it's barely detectable, but in the right hands, it can make a world of difference. And second, it's injected in tiny droplets across the cheeks. It can also be used off-label in other areas that appear dehydrated and crepey. It's really for people who don't want to look noticeably taut or plumper, but do want to improve skin quality, Alexades says. After about a month after injection, skin looks smoother and more radiant, healthy, and refreshed. Until now, fillers in the U.S. have had a high viscosity, which means they have to be used subdermally under the skin, says Alexades. The breakthrough with SkinVive is its water droplet-like consistency, which makes it intradermal, meaning it can be injected into skin. Results typically last up to 6 months. The price varies greatly depending on the location of your doctor and the amount used, but you can expect to spend anywhere from $650 to $1,500 per treatment. Consider a laser. Long before the recent backlash against looking too done, lasers have been the go-to for doctors to improve overall skin quality. If someone's skin is really weathered, I always recommend it, says Few, who likes the Halo, a device that uses multiple wavelengths to break down unwanted pigment and spur collagen production. Average price is $1,500. The treatment comes with a week of downtime, then you can expect to see glowier, clearer skin, and after about 6 months, smoother texture. This resurfacing tool is quite effective and has similar benefits to SkinVive, Few notes. And with the right training, a doctor should be able to keep beautifully unique characteristics like freckles, birthmarks, and signature benign moles. And there's a couple recommended products to go with this article. One is DanuCera Cerebalm. It's $95 at DanuCera.com and $122 at Amazon. At night, wash off makeup and the day's grime with an oil-based cleanser first. Apply it to dry skin and then rinse or wipe off with a warm, damp cloth. The next one is Aveeno Calm Plus Restore Nourishing Oat Cleanser. It's $9 at Amazon, $10 at Walmart, and $12 at Ulta Beauty. In the morning and at night, after using a cleansing balm, wash skin with a mild gel or cream cleanser. Oat and Feverfew help to calm sensitive skin. And there's Edam Cashmere Peel Gentle Exfoliating AHA Toner. It's $42 at Edam, and that's EADEM.co. Once a day after cleaning, apply a toner to gently exfoliate and balance skin's pH. This milky formula contains 5 acids, including lactic, azelaic, and transexamic, to address clogged pores and discoloration. And they have the Macrene Activates High Performance Face Serum. It's $195 at 13Lune, that's LUNE.com. Next, apply a serum with active ingredients. This patent formula uses a combination of more than 50 medicinal plant extracts to plump, protect, and repair skin. And there's two more. One is Skin Better Science Maestro Active Balance Serum. It's $225 at Skin Better. If skin appears stressed with visible redness or irritation, consider this calming serum, which incorporates adaptogenic ingredients, plant-based ingredients that help your body respond to stress, to reduce the flare-up, and also help with dullness, rough texture, and poor appearance. And the last suggestion is live-tinted HuGuard Skin Tint SPF 50 Mineral Sunscreen Broad Spectrum. It's $42 at Ulta Beauty. Last step, sunscreen always. This lightweight, all-mineral, broad-spectrum formula protects skin, and comes in 10 shades that won't leave a white cast. Over in lifestyle, what an adolescence expert wishes for every teen. In a letter to her grandson, the author of The Breakthrough Years shares her hopes, his future. And this article is by Ellen Galinsky. You were 2 years old in the summer of 2015 when I began writing this book. Now you're an early adolescent yourself. Over these years, I've had privileges few of us will ever have to deeply explore this transition from childhood to adulthood. Unique among those privileges was talking with young people themselves, asking them what their hopes and dreams were for a book about adolescence, asking them what I should ask researchers when I interviewed them. You were with me on one of those trips to Colorado, where I interviewed 17 high school students who'd been selected to spend a week at the Aspen Ideas Festival, participating in the Bezos Scholars Leadership Program. I know you don't remember what one of the students said to me. He said, "Look at us." That's because you were too busy looking at a menacing stuffed mountain lion at the lodge where we'd assembled for dinner. But I will never forget that student's words. He spoke about this group of young people, defying stereotypes of teenagers. He spoke about their passion to bring about change. He repeated, "Look at us. We're not what comes to mind when you ask an American adult to think of the typical teenager." At the time, you barely reached the top of the legs of the young man who was speaking. Now you'd be closer to his shoulder height. Now you could look him in the eyes and understand the meaning of his words because you've had experiences of how young people are treated. Over the years, as I've listened to the voices of young people and pursued these studies, my thoughts were always on you. I am always asking myself, what are my hopes for you? What have I learned that can make a difference in your life, in you, the emerging adolescent I care most about? I hope you retain the joy you were born with. I think about that week in Aspen, and I can see how you were bursting with joy in every photograph I took of you, as you reached up and touched that forbidding stuffed mountain lion, climbed on a pool table, and created mayhem with the balls and raced over the hills, often faster than we could run. In fact, in most of the photographs of you throughout these years, you are joyous. Of course there were tears, as dark and turbulent as the smiles were bright. I hope the world and the schools you attend don't take away the passion you have for life. I hope you keep your sense of adventure. When we go for walks then and now, I joke that if there's a stone wall to walk on, a massive boulder to jump from, or a tall tree to climb, you'll be there, running, jumping, and climbing. As you enter the teen years, you might be labeled as a sensation seeker, but I hope that's not seen negatively. I hope you live in a world where people are less likely to disparage teenagers, where adults understand that having a sense of adventure is positive, where they help you develop your passion to explore into learning, explorations, and positive risks. I hope all your needs are met. I hope you go to schools and are in groups where adults understand that it's our job as adults to create environments where meeting those needs is not a nice to do, but a must do. I hope that meeting these needs is seen as being as important as meeting our biological needs for food, water, and shelter. As a biracial child, you have the kind of stop-in-your-tracks looks where people literally stop you on the street to admire you. The way you wear your hair, the way you present yourself, your style. I hope that the adults in your life make you feel you belong. That we make every child, no matter their race, background, abilities, and disabilities, feel they belong and are cared for and cared about. I hope they give you and others genuine opportunities to explore your identities. Meeting psychological needs is key to your future, to all our children's future, and thus to our own future as well. I hope you always have something you want to learn about. My mother, at close to 100, said, "When you stop learning, you stop living." She was the epitome of her own philosophy, leaving a job she'd never much liked in her late 70s, becoming an art critic for her hometown paper, helping found an art museum, Reading for the Blind. In fact, the book club in our hometown is named after her. More than a decade and a half after her death, she was always learning. The biographies and autobiographies I devoured as a child and adolescent, especially the ones I remember, told the stories of people who overcome all manner of hardship in their lives because they had a sense of purpose, a sense of something they wanted to know more about so they could do more about it. Well, lots of parents worry about spelling or math or science proficiency. I am most concerned about your being strongly motivated to learn. You've always been that way, and I hope the pressure to succeed and achieve in our culture don't diminish it. Most of all, I hope that if you ever, as an adolescent, tell adults to look at us, it will be because you know that they, the adults in your life and beyond, understand and appreciate these years as the breakthrough years that they truly are. There's a book that accompanies this article. It's called The Breakthrough Years by Ellen Galinsky, and that's spelled Galinsky. It's $33 at macmillan.company. That's macmillan.com. Here's a gift suggestion for your best friend, the Lululemon Everywhere Belt Bag. It's $48 at Lululemon. That's Lululemon. For your pal who's consistently juggling a gazillion tasks, get her a bag that'll carry all the things without feeling bulky and won't need to be adjusted every time like a regular handbag. Plus, the pop of pink brings brightness to even the dullest of errands. And another one is the Uncommon Goods Birth Month Flower Heart Necklace. It's $50 at Uncommon Goods. This handmade heart-shaped pendant is filled with flowers corresponding to your friend's birth month. Plus, it comes attached to a 24-karat gold-plated chain. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.